Welcome to the Fire You Carry podcast. On today's episode, Kevin and I are excited to be joined by retired LA County Fire Captain Kevin Tobia. I worked for Captain Tobia for the last few years of his career here at LA County. He is a widely respected captain, and in this episode, he has some great pieces of wisdom about being a good fire captain, being a good husband and father, and what retirement looks like, and some good strategies to make sure that retirement is a positive experience, especially after a career like the fire service. Enjoy.
To the people that you knew and the people that you affected in your career, they still remember you, and those relationships that you built, and like Noel just mentioned, the brotherhood, that's still there. But as far as devoting 34 plus years of my life to the fire department, when you leave, you realize that you were a warm body in the seat of a fire truck to do a dirty job. And when you're gone, there's somebody else, there's another warm body that's going in that seat to take your place. Whether they do a good job or maybe they're doing a far better job than you did, nobody cares. And that's what you find out when you're a retiree. The only way that you can stay connected to the job is through the relationships that you made and the friendships you made.
Well, today we have one of our dear friends and mentors, I'll say mentor, is retired Captain Kevin Tobia. Welcome to the show, Cap.
Well, thank you for having me. My pleasure to be here and spend some more time with you guys.
No, I mean, I shouldn't say he's my captain. He's Noel's captain, right? I just was jealous of the guys, the B-shift boys, dude. Donnie Butler and the dude. That was like the classic shift. But I mean, that was just, to me, I was a boot coming in as on second spot. And Noel was that stoic Army Ranger. The dude was the dude. You can't explain him other than that. Donnie B was probably the funniest person alive and one of the best drivers of the truck that I've seen. And KT was the man that did everything right, you know? And like, I was like, I love working with those guys. Those are my, that shift is rad. And I was just always loved every day I worked with you guys.
Well, it's about having fun at work and enjoying what you do, right? I mean, I was on the job long enough to realize that the captain in the station can really mess up your day and actually mess up the job, you know, just make it so it's not enjoyable to come into work. You know, you learn a lot by those examples of how you don't want to be when you're the boss, as much as you learn about, you know, the people you want to emulate and kind of model your career after.
That is so huge. And in our line of work, it really is a very big deal. Your captain does set the tone for the day, and that can be amazing. And it can also be a bummer. And in our line of work where you're there for 24 hours or a lot longer sometimes, that can be a pretty big deal.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
I gravitated to asking permission to come work for you at your shift at your station because you taught in our training tower. You were the ladder instructor.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody failed ladders that class. We all passed ladders.
Right.
And it wasn't because you were easy on us.
No.
We all actually did the job. But I remember as I was going through, and that was kind of my first exposure to LA County Fire captains, was the training cadre. And I loved everybody out there. There were a couple people that were, you know, out there to be a little harder on us than others, but I loved them just as much. But when it was coming time for me to be done with probation and look for another spot, there were two things that I wanted to do. I wanted to get on a truck. I wanted to do truck work, and I wanted to learn how to tiller, so drive the back of the fire truck. But then I wanted to work for a good crew. I was looking for some good leadership specifically, very specifically, I wanted a good captain. And I didn't know you, Cap, apart from just being taught by you in the tower, but I knew that the way you carried yourself, the way you taught, the way you communicated, I knew you were a good man. I could tell you were an honorable man, and I was brave enough, which actually I was afraid, to be honest with you. I was nervous, but I remember calling up. I can't remember how I found out, but I knew the fireman at the time, and I don't remember his name, had gone to medic school and was just waiting for a spot. So I knew there was going to be a vacancy, and I remember calling and asking permission to cover the spot. And you guys said yes, which was a miracle for me. And I've never left that station. I'm still in the exact same spot. Everybody else has gone, and I'm still there. But
well, I know that, weren't you working with Tim Pudich? at the time? Were you at 145s at the time?
I was at the station he was at, but I was not on his shift.
Okay. Okay. Because I know that I worked with Tim for a number of years when I was at Fire Station 26, which was kind of the hothouse of that battalion at the time.
Oh, yeah.
The Venom. And, yeah. And I had a lot of experience with Tim. So, you know, I don't know whether he gave you or gave me a recommendation or recommended me to you. I highly doubt that. That'd be a little, that'd be a little bit less than humble to think that he would, but we were good friends and we went back a long time in training too. I did a couple classes with him and I had a lot of respect for him and hopefully he had some respect for me as well.
So oh, he absolutely did. And he taught my tower too. He was there as well.
Yeah.
This is what's funny is seeing behind the scenes, you know, cause Pudich in our tower was one of our raider. I mean, one of our instructors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he could verbally destroy anybody on the, and I was terrified of that guy. You know what I mean? Cause he's so witty, so sharp, you know? And then you worked with him and I was like, he's the funniest, nicest dude on the planet. And I'll say the first time, we saw KT, he was a raider in our academy, right? And as a raider, literally your life is on the line. He's teching you or failing you on a hose lay or whatever it is. And I'm looking for some sort of indication that I did this right or wrong, you know? And he had the hat and the glasses and he'd look down and either shake his head or there was a bad move. And I'm like, no, my life is over. But then I meet you in the station and he was like the raddest guy I've ever met in my life. And so it's really funny. Like I remember being so intimidated. I was like, this guy's super serious, you know? And then seeing him in the station, I'm like, wait a minute. He's totally rad.
It's really hard to assume that demeanor. Cause I know you have to, in order to, and I've had this experience with guys in the academy. If you are too cool, there's guys that will come through that. And they're that way throughout life. They'll start taking advantage and pushing. If you give them an inch, they're going to take a mile. So you have to kind of assume that persona, even if that doesn't even come close to who you are in real life.
The guy that we were the most afraid of in my tower, who was just a raider, he would come in for the raiding days, was Captain Murchison.
Murch?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He was, we were so afraid of that guy. We were like, he fails everybody. I don't know where the rumor came from, but he was doing that. He was having that demeanor and being very serious. And then I met him and worked with him later on, much later on in my career. And I was like, this is the best guy around. Like, yeah, why were we afraid of this guy?
Yeah. Yeah. I think most of us that either train, cause I raided a lot more classes than I trained. I think I only trained 3 or 4 classes, but ever since I got involved in training, and Tim Pudich was the senior training captain of the very first class I did. He's just super knowledgeable about all the ins and outs. He'd done so many classes and he knows everything. He taught every single
he taught all the different skills, like he taught ladders.
Exactly, all the different skills several times. So he was just very knowledgeable and it could make him intimidating because he knows everything. And he, I think he had eyes on the back of his head too. He would know when you did something wrong, even if he wasn't looking at you.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but you were nicknamed from the class, the Techinator.
I was?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
It was the Techinator because you held a standard, right? And so like, so how do you explain techs? Somebody explain techs, but if you got so many techs.
Yeah, you had so many techs before you'd actually fail, so.
It was like a technicality, like you pivoted one way and you're supposed to go left instead of right. And if you did that, you would get a tech. And I think if you got 3 techs, you failed that hose lay.
Correct.
And if you do enough fails in a row, you literally lose your job. And so they were like, oh no, I got hose lay A to the right. And Captain Tobias, the raider. You're like, oh no, I got the Techinator. And you're like, you had to be flawless. But I think what was rad is that you leveled guys up because you held a standard. The act, you just followed the rules. And I think, I don't know if this is correct. Noel would know better. But I think so many guys had respect for you because you followed the rules and said, this is what it is. This is what the policy states. And you either do it or you don't. And like, a lot of guys in our industry, I will say, we like to bend the rules or find the gray areas. And I always respected that for you because you were so consistent. And as far as a supervisor or a leader, like we always knew where you were stood. And I think that's really impressive. Like now looking back to say like, hey, you held the standard and you didn't break.
Yeah. I think there's areas where I wasn't so much of the standard policy and procedure follower. And that was kind of the thing. And I think the area where I was not like that was basically uniforms. You know, I always kind of thought the uniform standard, especially throughout my career, just changed so often. And I think that the last uniform policy and procedure change that was made was during my tenure at, gosh, I think when I was at 26's, and it was one of the guys who was in charge of that change was a guy who came over from a different agency that we had absorbed. And it was very draconian, and this is the way it's going to be. And it was not about your comfort, but about your appearance. And the one thing about the firefighter job that everybody that does that knows that it's not a comfortable job to be doing all the time. And I always kind of felt like the department never really made accommodations for the difficult job that we have to do and put too much emphasis on how we looked to the public. And I really don't think that in my mind and my experience, the public cared what we looked like. I think it was more about the administration and the management. They wanted us to look a certain way because they had to dress a certain way, but they actually weren't out in the field doing the work and getting sweaty and dirty and having to go through three or four uniforms a day on a hot summer afternoon because you kept sweating through your uniform and getting in and out of your turnouts for fire calls or false alarms or whatever they might be. So for me, it was like, I didn't ever think that the public really cared what we looked like. If we were at a formal event, that's one thing. You know, if we're at a school doing a presentation, that's one thing. Obviously, we want to be in uniform, but the management or the administration of the department used to make such a big deal about how we appeared to the public. And I think if you call 911, you don't care what they look like or what they're dressed in. You want them in your house taking care of you and taking you to the hospital and helping you solve your problem, whether it be a medical problem or a faulty outlet inside your house or your CO monitors going off in the middle of the night.
Absolutely. I have never been on a call where we're there for somebody's medical emergency or other type of emergency, and somebody has said, wait a minute, hold on. The three of you have an LA County fire hat on, and that guy's got a hat on with an American flag on it. American flag. It's blue, but it doesn't say LA County fire on it. What's he doing here? Why isn't he in the... No, I mean, it's not going to happen, of course, because of what you stated. They want you to come in and be competent and do your job, and people don't complain about that kind of stuff.
Right.
And when they're talking about things like station patches, which has been the issue off and on as long as I've been on the department, then you open up that can of, well, what's the purpose of a station patch? And it's morale. It's pride in your station. Also pride in the department, but really specifically pride in the station that you choose to work at, where your best friends are. And in my opinion, that is one of the best things about the fire department is that individuality of each individual station and the personalities that they have. One of the funniest things I ever heard on that, and I can't remember, it doesn't matter, I shouldn't say his name anyway, but we had a chief in our station, I think it was after an inspection, and he was talking about how they didn't want us wearing station patches at the time. And his example was, you know, in the military, nobody wears a different patch than everybody else. Everybody has the same patch. And I'm just sitting there looking at the guy and I'm like, what are you talking about right now? Every single unit in the military has their own patch and they all look very different and they have tons of history behind them and pride and guys wear them well after they're out of the military. And I didn't say anything because I was still pretty new, but I'm just like, you don't, that's not a good example.
That's not a bad example. Do your homework, bro.
I think it seems like the uniform thing was always a way to kill morale and the anti-station patch, always a way to kill morale from management. And I'm not trying to, you know, badmouth management now that they can't get to me because I'm retired. But it's I think it was just misguided, just really misguided philosophy.
Yeah, they just don't know. And I think part of that is because they're not in the station anymore. And so they lose connection with that day-to-day life and the guys. And it's understandable. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I would do if I was in that role, if I would lose that connection or not. I would hope not, but you never know. You're not in the station every day. You're not working with the guys. So it's hard to keep your finger on the pulse when you're not doing that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So one of the things I did want to talk about is that you were one of the most well-respected captains. And I think one of the most tenured in rank as a captain that I knew of. But I think what really hit home to me is I was working a day for you and your wife, Mom Sue, came in with Nikki and Connor, your kids, if I got their names right.
Yeah.
And she brought a big old cake And I was like, oh, it's cool. Is it Cap's birthday? And she's like, no, this is the day we celebrate when Cap promoted to captain and I quit my job. And it was this overwhelming, like I was newly married and, you know, we have read things like Love and Respect book, stuff like that. And I was just floored at how rad your kids were, how rad your wife was, how much respect and admiration they had for you and kind of being the leader and the provider for the family. And they did that celebration in the station, which I thought was amazing. And it really had an impact on me. And it was the start of me seeing how amazing of a person you are, not just a captain, if that makes sense.
Well, I'll tell you what, a little bit about that is I never remembered that date. She did. And that date could have come and gone. I would have never noticed that particular date. And I don't was, I can't even remember what date it was right now. I did get promoted fairly young. You know, I had a young growing family at the time and got promoted with just a little bit more than 10 years on the job to captain. So I think that must have been I think it was probably 1993 when I got promoted to captain. But she remembers that date. I don't.
How old are you? Do you remember about how old you were?
Just about ready to turn 31. Yeah, I was 30 years old when I got promoted to captain, and I turned 31 a couple months later. So I think it was February 1st. Just to put it all in perspective, I was promoted out of Band 3, and it was the first test when Fire Chief P. Michael Freeman had gotten there when he said, I don't want to downgrade a promotional test for captain because I think it dilutes the standard a bit. And he wants everybody that's going to be promoted to captain to be able to pass that test with at least a raw passing score of 70. So that being said, I was in a large group of Band 3 years. There was about 10 guys in Band 2, all the smart guys, you know, like John Tripp and all the Brainiac guys that ended up going all the way to the top. You know, I was just one of those above average guys in that test. And, but I was the last group of like the last 8 guys out of Band 3 that got promoted. And they took everybody on the list, but, you know, Band 3 was a pretty large band. I don't think there was anybody in Band 5 or maybe just a few guys. So, but I was the last group. I had to wait a long time when guys were getting promoted out of my band when they started. And I kind of had a feeling that my assistant fire chief didn't like me for some reason and just kind of made me wait it out. Maybe he thought I was just too young.
Made you sweat it out.
Maybe he thought I was just too young and cocky. I don't know.
Well, didn't you have some crews early on where there were guys on your crew that were now working for you that were much older?
It's funny that you should mention that. And I spent a month at a temporary assignment in Malibu. It was Station 72 up in Encinal Canyon. It was right there at the county line. You go up PCH almost to Ventura County line and take a ride up into the canyon. There's 110 miles from home, from my lovely home here in San Clemente. So it's a bit of a commute. So the first chance I got to get a permanent spot, I went to Fire Station 66 in Altadena. It's actually the fire station.
House.
Yeah, it was a rock house. It actually sat within the city of Pasadena, but it was there before Pasadena, I think, was even incorporated. So I worked there and I walked into the station as this, you know, snot-nosed 30-year-old fresh captain right out of the, you know, right out of the basin of LA. Never had any wildland firefighting experience whatsoever. And walking to the station, I got Terry Golightly, who's my engineer. And unfortunately, he just passed recently. And actually, I'm going to a flag ceremony this coming Wednesday at Fire Station 66 for him. And then Big John Humphrey, and anybody that's on the department that knows that name, he's a legend. He stands 6'7"
Ooh.
And weighs about, I don't know, 200. He looks like Andre the Giant, you know, as far as his stature. And they were both in their late 40s when I got there. And I was this 30-year-old snot-nosed captain that came in there. And I'm supposed to be telling these guys how we're going to do things. And I kind of came in with the attitude that, hey, I'm a brand new, fresh boot captain. I know nothing about wildland firefighting. This is the first time I've ever worked in a wildland urban interface fire station. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to need to rely on you guys and your experience. So I'm sure you're going to be able to teach me a heck of a lot more than I'll ever be able to teach you. So can you help me out? Show me the ropes and let's get on with it. And I've maintained a really close relationship with those guys. I only worked there for a year, maybe a year and a few months, but I still keep in contact. I still kept in contact with both of them throughout. They've both been retired for, you know, probably around 20 years. So I just, the way I found out about Terry passing, and I just played golf with he and John a couple years ago before COVID started, when John was out camping in Desert Hot Springs with his wife. So we all met out there with another firefighter, another engineer that worked at 66s with us at the time, and played, you know, round of golf and hung out there for a couple of days and just talked old stories and had a lot of good laughs. But I just, I keep in contact with John. In fact, I just got back a couple of weeks ago from visiting him, and he's still at the same campground. He does that snowbirding thing during the wintertime in an RV and lives, you know, in an RV for a good portion of the year when it's cold. So I went out there and visited him, and on my way out there a couple of days before I was going to leave, he told me about Terry's passing. But Terry had struggled with some battling cancer for the last couple of years. But I went up there, and here was this guy with two underlings that were basically 20 years my senior and had all the experience in the world in wildland firefighting. And I came in there as a rookie captain. So it was a pretty interesting dynamic.
That style of leadership right there, that I'll call it humble leadership. It's probably got an actual technical term, but I view that as being very humble while still being a leader, because you are the leader. You're the captain in that role. In the military, when you're in a platoon or whatever, you get assigned a lieutenant, and he is in charge of the platoon. But you get these guys, and they're usually straight out of training. They just got their rank pinned on. They're brand new, and they don't know anything. And so they come in, and I've seen two things happen. I've seen the guys that come in and try to put their foot down and change everything immediately, and it's going to be this way. And that doesn't go so well, because the people that they're over, that they've been put in charge of, have actually been doing this for a long time, sometimes for as long as a decade in the NCO ranks. And they just know how to do the job better. The other side of that is exactly what you demonstrated there, where you come in and you say, "Hey guys, I'm new. I need help, and I'm going to be here to support you, but I'm going to need you guys to help me and support me in my role." And I mean, I don't even have to say which way works better and which way is the proper way to do that. We all know which way actually works. And what happens when you try to go the other way and say, "Well, I'm the captain, so you got to do what I say." And there are times and places for that, of course. If you had come into that station and those guys were, you know, we'll just say trying to go two areas away from their area to get flowers for their wife or lunch or something, I mean, that's a place to put your foot down and say, "Hold on. I'm the captain. We're not doing that." But other than that, on incidents and stuff like that, yeah, you got to default to those guys until you pick up those lessons and you learn those things. And then you slowly morph into taking the other side of that role, which is the other half of the leadership picture.
Yeah. And how much more do you respect a guy that says, "I don't know, and I'm going to lean on your experience"? Then you've had those guys that we've worked for that pretend to know everything, right? And it's so clear that they don't know anything, right? And it's almost like very frustrating. And it would be from the bottom of the totem pole, it's much more refreshing to say, "Hey guys, I don't know much about AutoX. What do you guys do?" And then let's go from there. And like, I'll bring this up. So KT ran AutoX and started that back in the day with Donnie Butler. And when I was new, they're like, "Yeah, you can come out and help out," which meant like we fill up fuel in the power units and we pull out and check out the hoses, you know, and we're kind of just the gophers, you know, we're just helping stuff. But what was really cool is you watched us, you developed us, you mentored us, you taught us. And then at some point, I remember you specifically saying, "Hey, Kevin and Noel, you guys got to break up and you're going to lead a group." And I was like, "What? I'm terrified. How am I? I'm only 4 years on, 3 years on, whatever." And I'm like, "How am I going to lead a group?" And I remember specifically breaking Noel and I up because we were just palling around, and that you were like, "Break up and you're going to lead a group." And I was like, "Oh my God, Noel, KT wants me to lead a group." And you're like, "Yeah, dude, same with me." And then you fast forward. But I think that's what's so cool is that you identified guys, you mentored them, and then you threw them into the lion's den. And I'm grateful to that, because there's no other better way to learn than to do it, right? And to try to teach it. And so, you know, fast forward, we were like some of the guys that led the Auto X for the last few years. And it's only because you gave us a shot and put us into the lion's den, you know?
Well, and I think the thing about good leadership too is realizing the people that have the talent and the gifts to instruct. And I know you mentioned myself and Donnie Butler, but I have to mention Steve Shute, because he was the driving force behind everything. And all, you know, I mean, I think a sign of a good leader is someone that will delegate to the appropriate people. Steve Shute had, you know, bid onto our shift with Nolan and myself and Donnie at the time. And he was an expert. I mean, he's a subject matter expert in auto extrication as well as any other firefighting category you can think of.
He's incredible.
And it was like, you know, the best thing you could do is realize that this guy's been teaching at the Fire Academy. He's been teaching at Rio Hondo Fire Academy. He's a state certified instructor. I was a state certified nothing, honestly. You know, I got, you know, a lot of fire officer certification courses before I promoted to captain, but I don't really, you know, I'm kind of like the jack of all trades, but the master of none. And here's this guy on your shift who's the master instructor for auto extrication. So use his talents and support him. And that's the side of leadership. And I guess the style of leadership that I noticed that I respected early on in my career is, you know, you guys, we all work for the fire department. And as a leader, as the captain, the station captain, my job is basically working for you more so than you guys working for me. You know, you guys are the ones that are touching the patients. You guys are on the end of the fire hose. You guys have the chainsaw. You guys have the tools, auto extrication tools. You guys are doing the work. My job is to make sure you have the proper tools, the proper safety gear. It's my job to make sure you guys are comfortable, that you guys, you know, have the supplies that you need. And basically that's a station captain's job. Yeah, he has the ultimate say in how things are going to go. He has the ultimate responsibility, which is a huge factor that changes a lot of the dynamics of that leadership role. But I always kind of took my leadership as by example in my work ethic. You know, I can't expect anybody to work hard for me if I'm not willing to work hard beside them. The other aspect was, I'm really working for you guys. I'm going to make sure you're getting paid. I'm going to make sure your timekeeping and your training is up to snuff, that we're getting the training that we need to do the job right. And you know, and that you're not running out of toilet paper and paper towels and the rest of the stuff that goes on in the station that makes the station work. You know, and I think if you show your workers that you respect them and their environment and the working conditions, and you provide a good work environment, they're going to show you respect for being the captain and make you look good.
Let me tell a little story. I've actually told this story before on the podcast, but it was a while ago. Working for you, and Steve was the other fireman on the shift at the time. The only time that I can remember, and there was probably other examples, but I have a bad memory. But the only time that I knew that we had, I'll use the term let you down. You'll probably say it wasn't that way, but the only time I remember we let you down is we woke up the next morning after a shift and we were all in the kitchen and you just let Steve and I know, hey guys, I noticed that Dan Johnson was cleaning a pot that we left out overnight to soak. Let's just make sure that we don't leave any work left over for the guys coming on duty to do. And I remember being just devastated by that. You were totally, you weren't mean. You didn't yell. You didn't belittle us. You were just like, hey, let's just make sure that Dan doesn't have to do our dishes, which is, you know, totally reasonable and not something that we had done intentionally, but we had done it. I had left it in there. And I felt bad because I felt like I had disappointed you. And that was the last thing I wanted to do. Obviously, as a fireman, you know, we come in and I care about my job. I care about my career. I care about every aspect of it. So I'm going to do the best that I can, but I'm going to go above and beyond that if I'm working for a leader that I respect and that I want to make look good, that I want to just prove to that I appreciate the style of leadership and the fact that you trust me to do my job and you don't feel like you have to micromanage every aspect of that. And the contrast to that is when you have leadership that doesn't demonstrate those qualities and you're still doing what you're supposed to do. You're still following the orders, but it's not done as willingly. Maybe it's done a little bit begrudgingly. And then when things like that happen, it doesn't have the same effect on you because you're constantly being peppered with, no, don't do it this way, do it that way. And there's no trust there. There's no support there. It's a totally different thing. That's the only time I remember working for you that I let you down. And like I said, I'm sure there were other times, but that's the one I can't forget.
It reminds me of, Terry Golightly, who was my engineer at 66's when I first got promoted. We were referencing him earlier, and he said something that really stuck with me, and it kind of reinforced the leadership style that I was going to follow from that point. I kind of intended it, when I got promoted, that I intended my leadership style to be that way. But he said something really simple, but it was really profound. He said, it's not what you ask me to do, but how you ask me to do it. Because there was other captains there that were far tenured than me, had far more experience than me, but they kind of had that micromanaging style, and they had that leadership style that most people don't like to work for, that you're given your assigned work duties for the day, and then when you do those, he doesn't want to see you standing idly by and sitting down in the blue chair, whatever. So he finds something else for you to do and keep you busy all day long. And then what that does, it has the opposite effect, because once they figure out that, hey, if we get this done and we kick ass and do a great job and we get it out of the way so we can do something else for the day, he's just going to find something else for us to do. So then you have the opposite effect. You have guys that are going to drag that job, that most menial task, out for the rest of the day, and they're not going to really have their heart in it. They're just going to they're just out there trying to take up that time so they won't get inundated with more work. So that really stuck with me. And Terry always, we had a lot of mutual respect for each other, and John as well. And it was just, they appreciated not being treated like children because there's someone who's the boss. And another thing that I didn't ever like is I'm not a very confrontational person. And when I did have to confront something, I guess they always called it your, I don't know if I could say this on your podcast, the 10% asshole pay. 90% of the time you get paid, just do your job. But if you're a supervisor, you get that 10% pay every once in a while. You have to be that guy. And I did have to be that guy several times throughout my career, but I didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it. I don't like the confrontation. I think that we all know, and you guys are great examples of that, and I appreciated working with you guys throughout your careers, the short time that we had together. And most people like you. I think I always wanted to work with people that kind of self-motivated, but we all know what job has to be done. I mean, the department pretty much lays it out. So last thing you need is somebody that's constantly telling you how to do it and what to do. Because as long as you're doing your job, then the day's going to go smoothly. It's my responsibility to make sure we can have some fun while we're doing it.
Then there is another aspect of leadership in there too, is identifying those guys that do need that kind of attention. Because every once in a while you get a guy straight out of the tower or from wherever that actually does need that, because they don't have that work ethic, they don't have that motivation, or they just don't know because they're brand new. But it's being able to identify that person and then not apply that attention and that attitude to everybody else, because that's going to be detrimental.
Right.
And I've only seen that a handful of times in my career here where there are individuals that just need a little bit more help, a little bit more attention. But we do have plenty of examples of leaders that just treat everybody like that. Like everybody's fresh out of high school, has never worked a job and is lazy. And like, hold on, time out. We're not all that guy. Most of us aren't.
That's the job of a good captain, is to identify the person that needs help and get him the training that he needs. That's right. Kind of why I really, enjoyed my time, probably the last 7 or 8 years at the tail end of my career is when I got into recruit training. And it's a lot easier to do that when you're a younger man than it is when you're getting ready to retire. But, I enjoy the training aspect of it. And so when I got somebody in the station that needs to be trained, or an overtimer that wasn't familiar with the truck, then, hey, let's go out and train. Let's have fun. Let's do it together as a crew. I'm not going to, stick you, put the spotlight on you and say, well, what do you know about this? What do you know about that? Why don't you give me a drill on this? Why don't you give me a drill on that? If you don't know, you don't know. And to have some kid come up there, come into your station that's not familiar with the equipment that you have on the truck, he's going to spend, he could spend 2 weeks on that truck and still not know everything. So the best way you can do it is take him out and train him with your crew, get him up to speed.
Love that. Wanted to pivot for a sec. I had one of my first captains on the job. He's now in BC. It was Gary Harrison. He was a chaplain for the department. And I remember when I was leaving to go to 15 to my second spot, he said, "We're such a large department and we have so many different generations of guys that you will lose friends on this job." And it seems like recently you're into retirement and you mentioned your old engineer. And I know that you have other friends like in Orange and you've had friends. We, and even Noel, in our short time on the job, we have lost friends. And do you have strategies to know that, like, we are not like superhumans? And reality is, like, you touch base on cancer is a common thing. Like, do you have strategies that you've dealt with? I know you've had a faith and you've had fitness and you've always been a runner, to know that, hey, I'm losing friends, and it's kind of a weird position to be in, to know that here are these guys that were thriving at one point and that are now frail, you know?
Yeah. You know, I do. I have experienced that. I lost a friend last year who was a good friend of mine. And I met him actually through a mutual friend on the job. I hadn't ever met him before, but he said, "Hey, you know this guy? He lives down in San Clemente by you, and he plays music all the time. I always worked overtime at 35s, or I was his engineer over at 35s, and his name is Gary Rice, and he's a really cool dude. You should get together with him." Well, that was about the time when I was starting to play music in my first band, and we were looking for another guitar player. So I just called him up out of the blue, never met him before. And his wife answered the phone. She said, "Well, he's not here right now, but if you want to play music, I'm sure he's going to say yes. So I'll just have him call you when he comes back home." And we talked over the phone and met. We were like the best of friends ever since that first meeting. He came over with his amplifier and his guitar case in my driveway the first time I ever saw him. And we were going in the garage and we started playing music together. And that ended up being the first band I was in. It was a bunch of firefighters. There's two guys from Orange County and two guys from LA County, Gary and myself. And then there's one guy from City of Orange that was one of Gary's childhood friends. And that was the County Line band, the first
county
band I was
line.
In. Yeah.
County Line.
But, you know, Gary, he had been retired for about 10 years and he struggled with, he ended up getting throat cancer and going through the hellacious treatment that is for dealing with throat cancer, the radiation and the chemotherapy. And it just wiped him out. And I'm sad to say that he was struggling so much with the treatment and feeling ill that he didn't want to see anybody. He knew that the prognosis for coming out of throat cancer was good, but I tried so hard to stay in touch with him and I couldn't, he couldn't talk a lot of the time anyways during the treatment. So we texted back and forth a lot, but I said, "Hey, can I come over and see you?" And he just wouldn't let me come over and see him, 'cause I think he was worried about anybody feeling any pity. I mean, obviously we had empathy and were sympathetic to what he was going through. But he ended up fully recovering from that, at least for a while. And he had two good years where we kind of reconnected and ended up, you know, playing a couple gigs together again. And we always got together like once a month and got together just to play guitars. Played golf a few times, went on a few trips, road trips with just the guys going and playing golf and playing music. And then the cancer came back. It had probably metastasized prior to his treatment starting, and he ended up basically passing away from full system failure. He had it in his liver and in his lungs when they rediscovered it. But he was a man of very strong faith, and I got to spend some quality time with him just the days before he passed. Before he went into the hospital his last time, and before they put him on hospice, I got a chance to spend a lot of good time with him in those two good years. But when he started getting sick again, I was able to be there and help support him. And I got a couple of precious moments that I got to spend with him his last few days. And it was pretty touching, but he was a man of very strong faith. And the stories we heard when he was in the hospital before they sent him home to hospice, and he only lasted about 2 days in hospice when he came back. But the stories of him evangelizing to people in the hospital and to the nurses and to the doctors. And, "Do you know Jesus? 'Cause I'm going to go see Jesus pretty soon. So can I pray with you? And I want you to accept Jesus while I'm here." And And the stories that were being told were just so uplifting. And for somebody that was suffering and had suffered for so long, it was so inspirational to me. I don't think there's anything that prepares you for that, but it starts happening more and more as you age. You know, I turned 60 and I'm a relatively young guy and I'm only retired for 5 years. But, you know, dealing with loss goes back to, there's a couple very infamous incidents in LA County history. And I was on a couple of them. I was on the state fire when we lost Jimmy Howe. He was an engineer on 9s and I was an engineer on 163s at the time. And I was on that fire. I was, for some reason, I was not on the balcony because I was helping engine 165, who was the engineer there at the time. I was helping him get his water supply. And when that facade came down on top of everybody upstairs or on that second floor balcony, and that's what ultimately caused the injuries that Jimmy Howe succumbed to. But I was there and I was watching it unfold. And there was several other people that got trapped, including my captain. But most of the guys were able to free themselves. And then another incident that I was on was the Glen Allen fire. When I was at 66s with Terry and John, we were on the Glen Allen fire where we lost two FSAs from Camp 2. And
a lot of guys got burned up too.
Yeah, and a couple guys got seriously burned. And then Roy Rodriguez, Roy Boy still does a little walkthrough, like a walkthrough educational thing for the recruit classes when, you know, both the FSA classes and the recruit classes. And they talk about that because he's one of the guys that was on that crew. And I got a chance to work with Roy. He was on one of the opposite shifts for quite a long time when I was assigned to 26s as captain. So, you know, I've seen the loss of firefighters. Oh, and another thing, Ted Hall and Arnie Canones, when they died up at the burnover at the camp, Ted Hall was an engineer at 165s on my shift when I was at 163s. And we didn't necessarily vacation together, but we'd run into each other when we were on vacation, when our kids were all small down at, they used to camp at the campground right next to where we were. And we knew each other from work. So we kind of planned some of our trips. Hey, are you going to be out the river? Yeah, I'll be out there this week. And so I knew Ted pretty well, and mostly from work, but we did do a couple vacations and talk from time to time. So yeah, dealt with the loss of people that were on the job, but I don't think there's really anything that can prepare you for some of those closer losses. Like the one with Gary and the one with Terry. I didn't have a chance to see Terry as much, but Gary and I were really close before we retired for, I don't know, 20 years before I retired and the 5 years since. But nothing kind of really prepares you for that. But I think your faith gives you a hope and an idea of where you're going to go. And so I think the suffering and the I guess the sorrow and the grief is more for us that are still living, because we know that they're in a better place. And that's never a good consolation, I found. I've never used that before, but I heard that's not a very good thing to say to somebody that's just lost a loved one. Well, they're in a better place, so it's going to be okay. I've learned that maybe when you're dealing with somebody that's suffered a loss, it's best just to keep your mouth shut and just be there for them.
Yeah, I'd vouch for that.
Yeah. I don't know. Does that address your question or your thoughts?
It's great. I think Noel's dad, we talked about it earlier, but I think Noel's dad talked about the ministry of presence, right? It's like, everyone's trying to put out the fire, but then nobody's just being there for the family, you know? And I think I thought that was really wise of him to say, and he's got a lot of experience in that area, is just to say, be there. Does somebody need a sandwich? Does somebody need waters? Does somebody, you know? But it's kind of a weird position. I think some of our retirees, you give so much to the fire department, and then we don't hear a lot about some of these tragedies of cancer or illnesses afterwards, unless you're like deep into Facebook or you're in that crew of guys. But it's a common thing, and I know that, you know, I know that how supportive you are of Gary's family and some of the things like that. I think it's really incredible to hear those, because you're teaching us how we do this down the line, you know?
Well, I think it, like I said before, it's just important to be there, but to continue to be there. I think that Gary and I were good friends, and I would be doing our friendship a dishonor if I wasn't continuing to try to be there and check in on Debbie. you know, fortunately, his wife, Debbie, and my wife had, developed a really great relationship, friendship with us being in the band together and being firefighters. So, you know, Sue reaches out a lot, and then I'm always there. She needs help at the house from time to time. And there's several firemen that have made themselves available to help her out, you know, that are close friends of Gary's and hers and Debbie's as well. But, you know, I've been over there fixing fences and fixing this and fixing that. And Gary also had a really huge collection of which I'm trying to liquidate at this time, you know, of guitars and musical pieces of equipment. I got a whole bunch of stuff listed on OfferUp and Craigslist right now. And I got a big envelope in my safe out in my garage with a bunch of cash that I've got. So I could take that to Debbie and give that to her. But yeah, just being there and checking in on him. And, you know, Gary's been gone for close to a year now, you know, and she's been one that can attest to that, you know, the support starts to fade after a while. You know, everybody's there when you lose somebody and until the memorial happens, and then, you know, people start dropping off and the contact gets less and less. So we're just trying to do our best, both Sue and I, at trying to be supportive and honor the friendship that we had with Gary.
That's a great lesson for anybody out there listening. It doesn't matter if you're a fireman or not. When someone does lose somebody that you're close to, the support initially is incredibly important. But just like KT just said, that continuing support is actually, I believe, even more important because it does fade away. It's just natural. People have their own lives. I won't say they forget, but they kind of do, right? You get wrapped up in your own life and you do forget that those losses happen if they didn't happen immediately in your family. And I know personally, and I also know for other people that have lost, you know, loved ones in the recent past, as that support fades away, it does get difficult at times. And you don't need the same level of support on, you know, day 365 that you do on day one, of course, but you do still need stuff. And, you know, KT's example is perfect. People need fences put up. They need help getting rid of stuff that's in the garage. They need all kinds of things. And if you can be available for that, it's a huge blessing to those people who are family, you know, or people that you love. So let's not neglect that. And I know for me personally, I've been in places in my life where I probably haven't done enough of that, but I have also been in places in my life where I've been the recipient of that, where people were still checking in and present and available, you know, long after we had suffered a tragedy. So it's super important. And it doesn't matter who you are, where you work. You don't have to be part of our brotherhood to institute that in your own life.
Right.
Well said. So you talked about it a couple times. And I think what was really impressive to me is that you seem to be a well-balanced man. Like, we've seen some really, you were extremely competent and respected captain, but then you also had bands and you were an accomplished musician. And I remember going down and jamming with you with my like $150 pawn shop drum set and then seeing this unreal setup that you had and like watching you guys play, like you're actually accomplished. You're a real musician. And was that something that you were cognizant of to say, like, I want to have some balance in my life. It is not going to be just fire, 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 but my family's important. My passions, my hobbies, playing music, like doing other things. Was that something that you were aware of, or is it just happen?
I'm glad you brought that up because that's a good way to segue what we're talking about, you know, when you suffer a loss, that the world keeps going. You know, when somebody passes, life keeps going and it doesn't stop and time keeps going. And the same thing happens. And I was hoping you're going to get to this because we've talked about this before, you know, is the job. You know, the job ceases to exist at a point. And I've found out, I guess by experience, is that, you know, I came up with an analogy. I said, I thought to myself, when you retire, you know, you could be to the people that you knew and the people that you affected in your career, they still remember you and those relationships that you built. And like Noel just mentioned, the brotherhood, that's still there. But as far as, you know, devoting 34 plus years of my life to the fire department, when you leave, you realize that you were a warm body in the seat of a fire truck to do a dirty job. And when you're gone, there's somebody else, there's another warm body that's going in that seat to take your place. whether they do a good job or as good of a job as you did, or a better, or, you know, or not, or maybe they're doing a far better job than you did. Nobody cares. And that's what you find out when you're a retiree. The only way that you can stay connected to the job is through the relationships that you made and the friendships you made. I don't do a very good job of reaching out. I'm kind of more, I think I'd be considered more of an introvert or kind of a quiet type person. You guys don't know me that way. Once you get to be friends with somebody, and once I, you know, I feel comfortable and I've established a good relationship with somebody, then I, you know, you can't stop me from talking, as you guys probably know. But I kind of feel like, you know, it's hard for me to constantly be reaching out, you know, trying to claw back at the fire department connections, because they're just not there once you retire. I mean, I can still go back to the firehouse 15s, you know, where you are, you both work, and where, you know, Steve works and Donnie works. These, you guys are all guys that were on my crew before and I know real well. So it's easy to go back there and have coffee with you guys and stay connected there. But, you know, if I walked into any other fire station I worked at throughout my career, I wouldn't know anybody. They wouldn't know me. And, you know, you just kind of realize that your career's over. And I was okay with that. I really was. I mean, the last few months that I was on the job, I was just physically exhausted, mentally exhausted, emotionally exhausted from just the routine, the daily routine of getting it, not the routine of being in the firehouse, but doing the calls and getting in and out of my turnouts on the hot summer days and sweating and working hard and putting a BA on my back. And, you know, little things were starting to bother me, and I knew it was probably time for me to go at that point. And that's okay. But as far as the balance in my life, being a firefighter was something that I did. It was not who I was. That's probably the most important emphasis, or the important most important takeaway that I have as far as what my career was. My career as a firefighter was a way to provide for my family. Don't get me wrong. I believe with Zuniga, that little coffee mug, hey, best job I ever had. If I were a young man, I don't care what the working conditions are like right now in the fire department, how much has changed since 1982 when I got hired. But if I were a young man in my 20s, that's what I'd want to do for a career again. And I'd do it all over again. And I wouldn't think twice about it, because I just really actually love the work. I love to be able to go into work every day, and no matter what you faced, at the end of the day, you can go home and know that you made a difference in somebody's life that needed help. And it didn't matter whether it was, you know, helping somebody that fell, you know, an obese elderly person back up into their bed and it was stinky and smelly and gross. You know, that was still a big deal to them. And, or going to the convalescent home for the third time after midnight, you know, it gets tedious and laborious for us, but it's impactful for the people you're touching. And, that was the important thing about the job, is I felt good. Like, it's a noble profession. We're not millionaires. We're not going to ever be wealthy from being a firefighter, but you can kind of keep your chin up a little bit, hold your head up high that you're doing something, even though you're getting paid for it, which is the nice part about it, but you're doing something that's noble as far as a profession is concerned. But I always had interest in life, and now that I'm retired, it's like, I don't know how I ever was able to do the things I did when I had to go to work, you know, 10 days a month, sometimes 14, 15, 16 days a month, how I was able to maintain and do the things that I did before, because, you know, I'm retired. I have nothing else to do when I wake up in the morning, except for the stuff I want to do, not the stuff I need to do. And there's still not enough hours to get it all done. But it's true. I mean, it's the balance is how you set your priorities. I mean, my family, and I hear a lot of people say this, that, you know, my family is one of the highest priorities in my life, obviously. The priorities of your faith, and then your family, and then your job somewhere down the road. But there's one thing about the job that it's kind of like a second family. And I always had a problem with people who kind of disrespected that fire department family, and always used, well, my family comes first, as an excuse at times. I just kind of felt like, you know, my wife fortunately was able to retire after the birth of my first child when Nikki was born. You know, she was a full-time school teacher before that, and she wanted to stay home and raise her children. And I wanted her to do that. So that meant I needed to pick up my end of work. So the fire department was always there for me when I needed to pick up extra shifts of overtime. I might have to drive to Lancaster or Malibu to get those days, but it was still there for me to help me provide for my family. So when it came time for recalls during fire weather, I wasn't one of those guys that was going to avoid the phone call. I knew it was coming. I knew I was up for recall. You know, that was giving back to the job that gave so much to me and to my family. And my wife was always very understanding. My kids were always very understanding of the birthdays, the soccer games, the softball games, the volleyball games, the holidays that I missed, because they knew that my job would require me to be gone. And I'm a second generation firefighter too, so they kind of knew what they were getting into. But what I did to temper that was to try to make up for those opportunities to be there during the holidays that I missed. And, you know, the job afforded you some great time off with your vacation and your holidays and being able to TX days. I made that up with taking my family out on these wonderful vacations and taking days off when I could, when they had a big soccer game, when it was possible. But I really felt like the job is your second family, but it's also providing so much for your family that you have to show it the respect that it deserves. Not hide away from the strike team assignments, not hide away from the backfilling because a strike team's out and you need to backfill a 500 rig in one of the stations. And you might not be, you know, in your backyard or where you're comfortable. It's good. You might be in some place that your comforts aren't going to be the number one priority of the department at the time. But that's kind of giving back to the job that gives you so much.
I had a great conversation with Indy, our six-year-old, right along these same lines. And what I told him, it didn't come from me. Somebody else told it to me early on in the job. But I had been recalled that morning, first thing, and he was looking forward to me being home. And so as I got ready to leave for work, because it was my turn to be up, and I answered the phone when they called, he says to me, "Dad, why don't you just tell them that you're sick? Because I want you to stay home." So, you know, that breaks your heart.
Sure.
He's 6 years
old
and he wants to hang out and play Legos. But what I got to tell him was what someone else had told me a long time ago, was that, well, if I do that, then I'm making my day and my family more important than the next guy down the line. And it's not my place to do that. It's my turn. And this is what we signed up for. Sometimes this is the thing, but if I dodge this, it impacts somebody else. Like it's not a victimless crime,
right,
if you will. And if you have the brotherhood in mind, if you have the career and the job and the honor of that in mind, it's not an easy decision to make, because we've all been there where you get the recalls, you get stuck on the strike team and you don't want to go. You've got plans. The family wants to be with you, whatever that is. But if you do the right thing and you honor that, it is beneficial down the road. It's a good example to your kids. You're taking care of the other guys, and those things come around because eventually the other guy will answer the phone when you're second up and you don't get recalled that day. You don't even know about it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it goes around, but it only goes around if guys are willing to do that and to take responsibility and step up when it's their turn.
Right. That goes back to the, you know, your family's a priority, but is your family more of a priority to you than the next guy down the road that's going to get the phone call and going to lose his day with his family? So it's important to take your turn in the barrel, I guess. I was kind of tried to be that way and, you know, make it up to my family down the road and later on. And I think how my kids turned out, Sue did a great job with them.
Well, let's talk about this for a second, because you and Sue have been married for how long now?
Our 34th anniversary is coming up this year in July. So
34 years.
Yes.
And if you know anything about KT and Sue, it seems like you're active in your marriage. You're an active husband. You pursue your wife. And I think what's really cool is to watch is how incredible your kids are. They're successful, like well-adjusted, great kids. They've both been through college. They both have good jobs. I think you married your daughter off, right? And so it's really cool. And I want to see if you could talk about that a little bit, because as a fire, you want to talk about Sue and 34 years of marriage and raising really great kids. is because it isn't easy. The job does demand a lot, like you were saying. And that, I think you got to have, I think from an outside perspective, you got a soldier by your side, you know, and you guys have gone through a lot. And it's really impressive to see, like, hey, you guys have gone to a new place that Noel and I are not even close yet, you know?
Well, the active part about that is that we're constantly actively working on our marriage. You know, that's, you have to actively participate in your marriage. It's not just going to blossom to the place that we're at now if you don't work on it the whole time. And trust me, the adjustment of, you know, Sue had to do probably way more adjusting than I did when I retired, because, you know, as a firefighter's wife, you were running the household and you're taking care of kids and you're organizing this and you're paying bills. And it's like, honey, we're getting tight on bills to see if you can pick up a couple more overtimes this month. So you just basically are checked out of the home environment and she's taking care of everything. Fast forward to when you're home and every single day, every single minute of the day. And it's a big adjustment period, because I found out that the biggest adjustment from being somebody in charge of the fire station and then retiring and coming home, you're not in charge of very much.
You're not in charge of squat.
I was in charge of taking out the trash, mowing the lawn. I'm in charge of doing the laundry. You know, I mean, I'm in charge of menial tasks now, and I'm okay with that. I mean, I'm the kind of person that needs to stay busy.
Isn't that a funny thing though? Like, you would look at Noel and I and just give us a look and we would know we need to go run through a wall right now. Right. And like, there was no questions asked. And if you said something like a direct order, like, I need you guys to wash this rig, like, it wasn't a question whether it was going to get done or not. It was just when. Right. And it's funny when we go home, like, I don't know, and you're a captain, we're just a fireman, but it's funny because you can say the same thing, hey, babe, we need to get this done today. And she'll give you a look and I'll be like,
it ain't happening.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah, that ain't going to happen.
So, that ain't mind. Happening. Not today.
Well, I think the thing that helps us, and we developed this on one of our long trips. We've taken a couple long road trips in the RV. And, you know, we're both, my wife is someone who I really think that throughout our lives, I could just kind of hitch myself to her trailer hitch and she was going to drag me along. She did a lot of that, you know, spiritually. And I can give her credit for a lot of my spiritual growth, for her just kind of towing the line all the time, and that I need to start stepping up, you know? And, but I think what we developed on this long road trip one time was just praying together. And we hadn't ever really done that unless it was like, you know, there was like a family crisis or we're praying before a meal. We just started, when we were on this road trip, you know, we were praying for just, you know, safe passage, that we're going to have safety on our trip. And we're going to see the things that, and experience the things throughout our trip, and throughout that day that God intended us to see and experience. So we would do a devotion in the morning and we'd pray together. We'd take turns back and forth. And I think, you know, it hasn't been as consistent as it should be, but it is fairly consistent. We both, she probably mentions it and reminds me to do it more than I remind her, but it's something that keeps us moving forward and not getting stagnant in our relationship and in our marriage. And now it's just the two of us. You know, there's several things you have to grow through together. And one of them is retirement where you're home. The other one is the empty nester thing when your children are grown. And I look back on my kids moving out and how much, you know, I still enjoy seeing them when I get an opportunity to see them. And I relate that to my parents who still live in town and they're both elderly and they're both in their 80s. And I just think, you don't really ever realize how much your parents really love you until you have kids of your own. And then to think about the fact that my kids are adults and they're out, and my daughter's married and they live down in Carlsbad, her and my son-in-law, Trevor. My son still lives locally and he's saving up and he lives about a mile away. And I probably see him maybe once every 2 weeks, you know, he's literally less than a mile from my house, but he's got his own life. And just how much I still enjoy my kids and see my kids as the babies they once were and all those experiences that we had. And then to think of my elderly parents and two of the three children, two of us, of the three children that they had live here locally, and how much, you know, how much they still want to see us, and how much, you know, realizing that they still love us. Like I love my kids just like I loved them when they were babies. Yeah. It's something that's kind of opens your eyes a little bit, you know, when you talk about, keeping your family a priority and managing that.
It's hard to even imagine being at that stage, although I'm a little bit closer than Kevin is. Our daughter Avery is 17 and is already talking about plans on how she's going to escape the house and what she's going to go do. So we're a little bit closer, but those are such great life lessons for guys like us who are not near that yet, to just keep that stuff in mind. And I know sometimes when you've got the little ones, it's not even something that's on your radar, but it's good to remember, because I mean, every parent that's ahead of you in the journey, they all say the same thing. They all say the time goes too fast, or it's going to be over before you know it, or take advantage of every moment. Those types of things are always said. But I know for me, at least for our two bigger kids, Avery and North, who are 15 and 17, I do feel like, oh man, I missed out on some things. Like I didn't take enough advantage of that time. And not that you ever, you know, it's not a loss, because time, we're always losing time anyway. And there are a lot of future awesome experiences and impact that you can have on your kids. But that's my encouragement from here, and that is take advantage of those moments. And as the phases change, you just got to change your outlook on it and keep pouring into them, keep being available. And then, yeah, the transition of that too, where you're looking at your own parents and the amount of time that you're spending with them or not, or talking to them or not. And what does that look like? Where can we improve on those things?
Sure. Cause the parents are on, at least mine are on a lot shorter time frame that they're going to be around, and where you can still enjoy them. And the one thing I've been able to do, one of the things I've been able to juggle is, you know, is spending time with my parents. So I know that, you know, Sue recently lost her mom last year as well. It was just 2 weeks after Gary passed away. And, you know, the one beautiful thing about the relationship that my wife had with her mom is that she doesn't have any regrets about not spending time with her and not being there like some of her other siblings do, because they weren't close geographically. And even when they were kind of close geographically, they got so consumed in their own lives, they never really took the same amount of time or same amount of devotion of time with their mom. And so, you know, it gets a little tedious for me, you know, my dad, not so much. My mom's kind of really demanding sometimes. and I've had to set up some healthy boundaries, you know, a few years back, because she was just inundating me with phone calls and questions. And can you do this? Can you do that? Can you come up here and do this for me? And cause your dad can't do anything anymore. You know, my dad's suffering from Parkinson's disease, and in 2 weeks, he turns 87. So, bless his heart, he's still with us. And I take that time every Monday. I go up and spend the day with him. We used to play golf once a week until he couldn't play golf anymore. But, you know, I just, every once a week, at least once a week, I see them. I take my dad out and we spend the day together going to lunch and running errands or whatever else he has the energy to do. And then I bring him back home and sit with him till he falls asleep.
That's cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. You don't have to wait. Like I lost my mom 3 years ago, and my pops Leon had been struggling with some health stuff recently. And one of my buddies says, why do we wait for the ish to hit the fan to come together, where the family comes together, extended family comes together, friends come together. And it was really, that really hit home to me, to say, like, let's try to maximize the time that we do have. And try to be present and try to be with the ones we love and the ones that love us, right? And say that and not wait for catastrophes to happen for that to happen, you know. So, but it is a struggle, because you do get busy, and the kids got soccer, and we got trips to go to, and we just get busy. And so I think for me, I mean, talking to you and having experiences myself, is to say, maybe I don't need to be so busy. Maybe I should open up the calendar a little bit to allow more time for family, you know,
because your family is the most important thing to us. It's where we feel the most love, where our strongest relationships are. I remember when my kids were growing up, my daughter was, you know, a little bit overly witty and liked to kind of make fun of my son and always kind of tease him and wouldn't want him to hang out with her when her friends were over and all that kind of stuff. And I just, I kind of struggle with that just because, you know, they're different, you know, one's a boy, one's a girl. They actually shared the same room. And we moved to San Clemente and bought this house, and it was a tiny little 2-bedroom, 2-bath house. And it took me, especially with my wife, once Nikki was born, you know, us being a 1-income family, it took us a while to get to the point where we could remodel the house and the kids could have their own bedroom. So until my daughter turned 10 and my son turned 7, they were sharing the same bedroom. Because they're sharing the same bedroom, there's always those typical struggles. But I was really impressed upon them the fact that, you know, you guys are brother and sister, and you're always going to be brother and sister, and you're always going to love one another, and your friends will come and go throughout your life. You know, your high school, your grade school friends won't be your middle school friends. They won't be your high school friends. You know, they won't be your college friends. Some of them will stick around, but the one constant is going to be your family. And you only have one brother. You only have one sister because we have 2 kids. I said, so love each other, treat each other with dignity and respect, support each other. And it's a nice thing to see now that, you know, my daughter's 30 and he's 27 and she's married and he's, you know, probably heading that direction. I mean, I'm not making any predictions, but he's pretty serious and they're both moving on into adulthood, but they're still really close. And that's one thing as a parent, you can sit back and kind of warms your heart a little bit to see them connected in a way that, you know, that I kind of felt with my siblings, but you see a lot of other families not have that connection with adult children or, you know, or we see, you know, maybe some distance between some of our siblings. Fortunately, I don't feel that way in my family. We're all pretty close, but I do see estranged families where brothers and sisters don't talk and families don't talk anymore. And I didn't want that to happen to my family from within, you know? So, you know, I take a little bit of credit for that. The rest of the credit for raising the children goes completely to Sue.
But it takes work, right? It takes teamwork, and that does take a focused, conscious effort. It takes knowing that that's a goal, and it takes the willingness to talk through the hard things when they come up and work through that stuff and make it a priority and make it known to the kids that it's a priority. I think that in and of itself is huge. Just letting them know at a young age, hey, it's not okay for you to fight with your brother or your sister all the time. These are relationships you need to foster and that are going to be important to you in the future, even if you don't know it now. I mean, kids are wildly impressionable when they're young. I mean, that's when we learn everything. And just giving them that guidance right off the bat to say, hey, this is how it's going to be and this is how it is in our family. I think that's hugely valuable. I mean, that's a good lesson even for me.
Yeah.
Let me sell something real quick.
Oh, but wait.
You guys are hearing a ton of awesome wisdom right now coming out of KT, and we've been excited to do this podcast for quite a while simply because of who KT is and how much we love and respect him. You guys have an opportunity to come and hang out and actually get to talk to KT personally and be around him at the coming Fire Up program that we're doing in May. What are the dates?
May 16th through the 18th. It's a Monday afternoon, Tuesday full day, and you leave Wednesday by 10 a.m. Let's go.
Yeah, come on down. KT is our, what should we call
PC,
him? What's his title?
Permanent cook.
No, we called him our senior mentor.
Was it senior or seasoned?
Seasoned. We like extra seasoning. Yeah. He brought his own seasoning, actually.
He did.
So, this Harris is the cool. I'm glad you brought this up. I was almost, but now the shirt, you can't see the shirt that he's wearing, but he's in the Fire Up shirt. And Nolan and I founded this thing. We started this thing as just a kind of our ministry to bring guys up and to do the things that Nolan and I like to do. And it was cool. A lot of guys got so much out of it and it's grown crazy. But we called randomly because in the program, we're getting busy doing all the things. I was trying to cook and work out. And we had this idea to get our mentor to come up and to have like the Tuesdays with Maury session and get the value that Nolan and I had, right? To say, but how much did you learn, Noel, when you were just chopping, you know, salad up for KT? He would ask you questions about your life. He would get into your thing. He would give you advice. And like, that was invaluable to me. And so what I think is the coolest thing in the world is that even though you're retired, we've kind of built a little fire, a mini little overtime for guys to come up and we get chances to have you mentor the guys like you have mentored us. And I think it was amazing that you even showed up and that you're into it. And it's the coolest thing ever.
Well, I just was impressed with the program. And, you know, I know that you geared a lot of the work that you guys do is geared towards people that might be interested in the fire service, but having a son who is coming of age and is maturing and, you know, is moving on to that portion in his life where he's, you know, going to be getting married and hopefully raising a family. And he, you know, and he's, you know, up to his eyeballs in work, that everything that you guys are teaching up there is so valuable in life in general. You know, you don't have to have a fire service or a public servant type of career in mind. Just the way you guys establish these priorities and talk about leadership, which is important in whatever line of work you're going to find yourself in, you know, developing character and integrity and setting your priorities right. So your God is coming first and your family's coming next and your job's somewhere down the road after you're taking care of yourself. You can't do any company very much service if you're unhealthy and you're going to die at, you know, 45 of a massive heart attack, you know, and you're not doing your family or anybody else any good either. So the fitness portion of that is very important. But, you know, just the way that you guys interacted with these young men, and I just thought, you know, it impressed me, and I wish that there was some kind of mentorship program like that for me when I was at that young, impressionable, early father years, you know, or early, you know, early years of a marriage. Before you start raising your family or when you have a young family, to kind of get things put in perspective by people that have been, had the life experiences that you guys have had. And obviously you guys have had a lot of a life experience before you got on the fire department. Me, I was just, you know, just out of high school and bumbled around in college for a couple of years before I got into the fire technology program. And I wasn't even through my second semester of the fire technology program at Santa Ana College when I got two job offers. So I was just thrust into it at 20 years old, you know, not really knowing what I was getting into at the time. But it's a great program. And I think there's benefits for any young man who wants to get put on the right track, regardless of where he's headed for a career.
Well, it's super humbling to hear you say that. And we are very excited about having you back. It's super fun just to be able to hang out, but then also to witness the conversations. Like I said in previous podcasts, every time I walked past the kitchen or wherever you were at, there was another guy talking to you about something going on in his life. And that's exactly what we appreciated back in the day when we were all working in the station together. And it's really cool that we can kind of pass that on to some guys now.
And the guys are watching a different form of leadership from you too. It's that humble servitude, that humble servant, because you are a man that has accomplished a lot in his life. And yet we're out there busting our butt. We're cutting line. We're doing workouts. We're doing a lot of hard things. And that you busted your butt in the kitchen so that we could have a hot meal right when we got back. And it was amazing to watch that. That is, to me, is a form of saying that's an incredible form of leadership, like you were talking about as a captain, to say my job is to feed you, to pay you, to make sure you're safe. And you do that in another way, but it levels us up to show, okay, that's what it's supposed to look like, you know?
Well, yeah. And at my age now, I can't do a lot of things you guys are doing physically anyways. I mean, I could go cut some line and hike, but I certainly wasn't going to be able to do some of the fitness things. And you certainly weren't going to get me into a frozen bathtub, frozen freezer full of water.
Come on. You go in the ocean. It's only like 30 degrees colder.
I've never touched the ocean when it's been below 65 degrees without a wetsuit on. Trust me. I don't even go in the ocean unless I have a wetsuit and a surfboard with me anymore.
Well, that's fair. I don't go in the ocean at all, so.
Well, I wanted to say, like, I have that YouVersion Bible app and I opened it today knowing that we're meeting today on the schedule, and it said it was Proverbs 27:17. Yep. It says, as iron sharpens iron, so a friend sharpens a friend. And I don't think that was by coincidence, that because I've always felt that with you two, is that you guys are the iron that sharpens me. And I think, like, I'm so like grateful and humbled that you're still doing this and you're doing the Fire Up program with us, because I feel like you guys level me up like you couldn't believe. And so I just loved reading that this morning, because I was like, yeah, we're talking to KT later.
Well, I hope you know that I got a lot more out of it than I was putting in. Trust me. I really did. I was honored to be asked. I was even more blessed to be able to be there with you guys. It was just an all around great experience. And I would recommend any young man who wants to get into the fire service or not to be able to experience that, because it's just a great program, and it definitely puts your head in the right place and gets your life pointed in the right direction. And I think you guys are two great individuals to help young men get started on the right path. Nothing but respect for you guys. Nothing but respect for you guys.
It's mutual, obviously. And we really appreciate it. You guys got to come out. Come out to the Fire program. Hang out with us. There's a lot of other really good dudes that are going to be out there. KT, thank you so much for being willing to sit and talk to us. I really think we got to do this again, because there's actually several things that I didn't touch on. But this has been awesome, and I really want to thank you for your time and willingness to talk to us.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me.
Let's say happy 60th birthday. KT and Sue are going on to Kauai. What an amazing thing. And I think you're doing retirement right. And I just love all the what you're doing. It's amazing. So, but yeah, thanks again for your time, Captain. We got more rad stuff with you down the line.
Cool. Love to be there.
This has been the Fire You Carry podcast. Thank you guys so much for listening. As you heard in the episode, the following dates, May 16th, 17th, and 18th, are the official dates for the next Fire Up program. We really want you guys to come out and join us. Please follow the links in the show notes to go get on the waiting list for that. We would love to see you guys out there. Big thank you to Captain Tobia for spending time talking to us on this podcast. We will see you guys next week.